Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting broadcast coming live from New Zealand. The fabulous, the fluoridated, the Fukushima irradiated, where everybody is not worried about the economic collapse because everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest joining me today from the wilds of New Zealand is John Ansell. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny. I love that intro.
I love it too. I was actually just pissing myself
off. Like
yeah. I was pissing myself laughing at myself. That's how egotistical I am. So today we're going to be talking about a few actually quite pressing and important issues for a change on this show. But I feel that I've become a bit more worldly and by being more New Zealand-centric, you know what I mean? Because it's kind of like the issues that are going on here in New Zealand translate very directly into things that are going on in other countries, I think.
Yeah, we've always had to, look at our television viewing over the years. We get the American stuff, we get the English stuff, we get the Australian stuff. We're a test market for Toyota cars. We're kind of out there in the middle of nowhere, but we've always had to kind of be aware of what the rest of the world is doing, even though they haven't got a clue that we're doing it, that we exist. But in this interconnected internet world, it doesn't really matter where we are, but we do actually have quite a good perspective on what's going on, don't we?
I think that we may do, and we maybe not. I found that it doesn't come down to the region you're from. It comes down to the person you are, what experiences you've had, what things you've been involved with, what people were there to mentor you in your darkest times and help you out of the facade of bullshit and propaganda that we call life.
That's deep. That's deep. Well, that's got me off on another tangent. But I think, on the other hand, we in New Zealand are tremendously smug and, to an extent, very naive and what I call nicest. The disease that we have down here, this end of the world, is terminal nicism, where we, and this is where we connect with such issues as the Treaty of Waitangi industry, we would rather give our country away than be called a nasty name, you know. And so we do have our own particular affliction. It's not shared by Americans, I don't think, looking at what Trump's doing and people overseas, but we are so nice. And I think we've got to learn from the more, I don't know, more aggressive societies, societies that have to struggle a bit more than we do. Otherwise, we're going to be overrun by all sorts of forces, aren't we, Vinny?
Well, one would argue that we already are, and that the people who have already overrun us have decided that, hey, you know, it would be really great if people never figured out that they've already been overrun.
That is true, and that's why we need a new political movement. Are we going to talk about that, or what are we going to talk about?
Let's go for the political movement first, because that could take up the bulk of the show. But also, there's the importance of the flag issue. I'm aware that your flag design got a very, very high rating in the competition, yet was not included in the final selection for New Zealanders, and that was very interesting. You know what was really a lot more interesting, John, is that when I was editing a video for a charitable organization, just over Skype, you know, the director and me just sitting there making a video, when I put their logo on a white background, the strangest thing happened. It looked like your flag, right? it just came up, and I was like, whoa, that's some synchronicity right there. I'm going to be tuned into this puppy. But yeah. So a government that acknowledges synchronicity and the fact that there isn't one reality, there's two, one in which we exist simultaneously, that's not right here in three dimensions, I think that'd be quite interesting.
Oh, you're going deep again. Well, I'm the opposite of you. I skate around on the surface. I'm interested in simplicity. My brain cannot operate in as many dimensions as yours. I like things to be simple and clear. And, for example, when it comes to representing my country, I believe we should default to common sense and tradition and go with the unique colour that our country has become famous for and the unique symbol. And you don't have to go any further than that. But everybody complicates everything, don't they? Everybody complicates. I'm just a humble ad man. Well, maybe not so humble, but I'm in the business of simplifying things. And I don't think that people have too many slots in their heads for most things. And when it comes to New Zealand, all those people who are listening from America who've barely heard of New Zealand, I don't think you've got too many slots for too many symbols for a little place like this. So I've been thinking for the last 30 years about what a New Zealand flag really ought to look like. At the moment, it's got the Union Jack in the top left corner to represent our colonial tradition. It's blue. I guess that represents the sea as much as, well, it's really just the colour of the British ensigns that they applied to all their colonies. And we've got four stars, which represent, it's a kind of a Christianized version of the Southern Cross. Apparently it was designed by a Christian guy. So that's why we've got four red stars and Australia's got a few more. But now we've got a chance to have a new flag. And the one that by various, by an undemocratic process of the Prime Minister selecting 12 of his most reliable sycophants to choose, first of all, 40 and then was it 4, and then they added, under pressure from a bunch of activists, they added another 1, which predictably didn't rate. And so now we're down to a flag which is kind of something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue. It's exactly what happens when you get committees to design things. It's half the old flag and a bit of the new, a bit of a nod to the silver fern, which really the whole thing should be. So it's four colours, which is one more than we any flag really ought to have. It would have been more coherent if they'd stuck with Kyle Lockwood's red, white, and blue one. If you're going to have, if you're going to acknowledge your British ancestry in the old flag, you might as well do it in the same colours. And so it's going to get thrown out, I would think. The public, by the way, preferred the red, white, and blue one, but by a quirk of so-called democracy, the voting system, very similar to the one that gave Wellington the mayor that it doesn't want, based on what the people whose views had already been rejected thought. I think it was STV system in Wellington and the preferential voting for the flag, but they no longer go with the majority view, which is a bit strange. But anyway, my view was that the flag should be based on the silver fern, which is, for those that think I'm anti-Maori because of my statements about racial equality, it's actually a Maori symbol. It represents, I think it was originally, the silver fern was laid down in the forest at night to guide the warriors home, became adopted by the first native rugby team, which is has a disproportionate importance in New Zealand culture. Sport is just as much of a cultural element as anything else, along with the colour black, also chosen for that team, which ultimately became the national colours, which of course spread beyond sport, but beyond sport into all sorts of government institutions. And if anybody is aware of New Zealand in the sporting realm, and we're quite good at sport, you know, we win world championships with regularity. That's what I want to get onto when I come to talk about the political party idea. We should be aiming to be world champion nation in every way, just like we routinely do in sport. We're the world back-to-back rugby championships champions. We almost won the cricket, remarkably. We've got a couple of guys that haven't lost a rowing race in about 8 years, and a shot putter in the same category, more or less, and a golfer who's number one. All these things we can do from down here. And yet when it comes
even
to...
Even conquering Everest.
And conquering it. Well, I said to John, I used to work for John Key once. I couldn't take a paycheck. In the end, I thought anything I think of that's any good, he'll kick out. I wanted him to go to Havelock School. Now, Havelock School is this little place. Havelock is this little place in the Marlborough Sounds, top of the South Island, where in the space of 30 years, the man who took the world down into the smallest thing, the atom, that's Lord Rutherford, and the man who 30 years later went there, he took the world up into the biggest thing, space. He was the head of the American space program, William Pickering. They both went to Little Havelock School. And on top of that, the man who took the world up to the biggest thing on Earth, Ed Hillary. So, you know, this is all good stuff for New Zealand's national aspirations.
Either that feeling. Or Havelock has luck.
Havelock has luck, yes. I'll do the jokes. Okay. So national symbols are good, and why wouldn't you use the silver fern on the black? My flag was configured a bit like Canada's, with the central panel in black and the silver fern inside that and the two white panels on the outside, just like Canada has red. Now, I'm a creative person. I'd rather have been original, but in the course of 30 years of designing this thing, I had to admit in the end that Canada had the template right. So this was the flag I put up. The only time it was ever tested against the other finalists, it beat them. But that's not to say that the public would have gone for it. Plenty of people have. But the point is, the sinister point is that John Key, because I used to be the golden-haired boy in 2005 that designed their billboard campaign that was much lauded at the time and helped them to nearly win an impossible-to-win election. But I've turned traitor because of the way that they've run the place, particularly the way that they're surrendering our sovereignty to Maori tribal corporations for no good reason at all. I'm not liked in that area, in that party. So it can only be that reason why this flag, which certainly was one of the top 40, you'd have to say. I mean, anyone would say that. If not, I mean, Kyle Lockwood himself said it should have been there in the final four. And, of course, I'm sounding like a real skite saying all this, but, you know, it happens to be true, I think. It should have been in the top 40, but this is the way that our country, which is supposed to be a non-corrupt country, works. You know, the Prime Minister installs his favourites. He installed the same chairman of the flag consideration panel as was the chair of the Constitutional Advisory Panel, which was a highly racist organisation, which predictably, you know, said that we should have a Maori constitution and all this. It's shameful what's going on in that area. And meek little New Zealanders kind of do nothing. A bunch of us get agitated on blogs and things, but we don't actually do anything about it. And I think we need to. I mean, as far as the flag goes, we're about to probably vote out the favorite alternative flag, the blue, white, and black. Why would you have a flag in the color of bruising, you know? But anyway...
Maybe after you kick the country in the teeth with your flag choice, despite what their wishes were. Just taking a stab in the dark.
Yeah. Well, I hope we kick it out, because it's not good enough. It's a flag with a flap. I mean, I like the guy that designed it. I support him, and I'll actually be the first to congratulate him. And also the guy, Lewis Holden, who is running the Change the Flag campaign. He's not doing it with any particular flag in mind, but good on him. He's also been running a Republican campaign, and I hope he does so again when the Queen passes away, because then we'll have the prospect of boring Prince Charlie ascending the throne, and then I think you'll get quite a groundswell for New Zealand to become a republic. And at that point, I'll be wheeling my flag out again,
yes, and
saying, "Why don't we actually make a a bold declaration of independence. The current alternative flag is a declaration, a meek declaration of semi-dependence. You know, and that's ridiculous for a country that's been independent for 50-odd years anyway, 60, I think.
Semi-dependence, is that like partial pregnancy?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of, we're kind of nervous Nellies. We're not quite prepared to go the whole hog like a Canada. People say there are going to be all these dire consequences from changing our flag, you know. One guy, he quotes the law of the sea, and he says, Key needs to have a new flag in order to implement the TPPA and all this stuff. There is not a shred of evidence, and you don't have to look at Canada. And they say that, oh, if we change the flag, the Maori people will be disadvantaged. Have the First Nations people in Canada been disadvantaged since 1965 because they changed to a maple leaf flag? I don't think so.
Mm. Well, this reminds me of Eddie Izzard's joke about how what does he say? The British conquered the world with the cunning use of flags. They went to India and they planted a flag down. They said, "This is ours now." And the Indians went, "Well, it can't be yours. We've been living here for a long time. There's hundreds of millions of us. Do you have a flag?"
Benny, that is a stunning impersonation, if I may say so. And I have a good ear for these things. And that is a bloody good Eddie Izzard. But that's right. Of course, we had a flag. The chiefs got together a bit of a flag in 1835, which they, of course, for their political advantage, now say, the descendants say, that that's that was the original New Zealand flag. It was, but the Declaration of Independence was a bit like a marriage, an arranged marriage where all parties hated each other, and in fact, these particular parties, as soon as the ceremony was over, tried to kill each other. So there's all sorts of nonsense comes up when you have a referendum process where the issues are opened up to people. But I think it's tremendously healthy to air all points of view. That's why I think we need more direct democracy. Mr. Key has opened a real, what do you call it, a can of worms, a Pandora's box? A box of Pandora's worms? I'm not sure. But
he's pulled the pin off the grenade or something.
Yes, that's more like it. He has, because he's allowing us to have a binding referendum on the issue of the flag, which even I, as one of the participants, don't think is the major issue, although I do think we can cope with more issues than one, and I don't buy the argument that, just because we're having a flag referendum, we're going to take our eyes off the TPP and all that stuff.
Exactly, because that would just be flagrant disregarding,
Well, flagrant, absolutely flagrant, yes, well done. You didn't mean that, did you, flagrant?
I did.
But obviously we've been more than capable of moaning about the TPP as well as the flag. But the point is that Key is allowing us to have our say on the flag. He's not allowing us to have our say on anything else. All that's much too, we're not grown up enough
reminds
to have
me
our say. The important things.
Of a great Facebook meme, actually, there was a list of like 20 really huge issues that he's not allowing us to decide it on. And then there's this is what he is allowing us to decide on. And there's only one issue, the flag. That's it.
Right. That's right. And I think that having opened that particular box of worms, it's going to be hard for him to close it because it's going to haunt him. Now, what do I think about the fact that it's probably going to lose? You see, if he does get up and win, if he's right and people are going to change the flag at the last minute, then I would have to take my hat off if I was wearing one and say that is a masterful piece of political prediction that far out to calculate that he's going to win that one, because it was looking very unlikely. It's been looking very unlikely right the way along, and even now I think it's looking pretty unlikely that he's going to win. And that's going to cost him electorally, I would think, because that's a serious defeat for a man that staked so much on that. I mean, I sat in a car with him in 2006 when I was in the good books, And I raised the subject of the flag with him then, because I had in mind this black and white thing of mine. And he said, oh, yes, I think that'll be a pretty good second-term issue. Now, in fact, it's a third-term issue. But doesn't that show you the motivation? The motivation is not that, you know, we should have a flag, a new flag, for the sake of New Zealand, but second-term issue means a distraction when we're starting to lose popular support. And I found that a pretty telling comment. I want a new flag because I want my country to have a world-class flag. That's why I want one.
We appear to have lost John Ansell, but don't worry, ladies and gentlemen. I have foreseen this as a possibility, and I am now going to call his cell phone here in New Zealand. So, wait, are you back, John?
I didn't know I'd gone. I've been prattling away to you, unbeknownst that I've apparently dropped out.
Well, that's real convenient, because it means I don't have to call you on your cell phone. So that's good. So
what did I last say? Can you remember, or you're asleep?
No. I wasn't asleep. However, when I get distracted and try to like resolve technical issues, sometimes the things that was last said really baffles me. But what I do recall specifically is that you said that it was a very telling comment about John Key about the second term issues. But
yes, well, I just think that shows that his motivation is more about political tactics than about any real desire. I mean, I don't think John has any principles at all. He's not encumbered by principles. And this is what I mean, I stood in front of the National Party MPs that were elected in 2005. They actually clapped me into the caucus room because of the effectiveness of that red and blue billboard campaign. John Key got up and said, you know, if it wasn't for you, a lot of us wouldn't be here, which I thought was very touching. But I said to those guys, I said, you know, you've got to decide whether you want to campaign on your principles or just stand next to a large angry crowd and agree with it. And one of them, it's the Trade Minister, Grocer, I think, he said, yes, I like the sound of that large angry crowd. And they all hummed and I thought, hello, what have I got? And another guy said, oh, yes, well, principles are all right once you are elected. And then another guy, the guy from Hamilton, David Bennett, went beetroot red in the face at the very idea that someone had mentioned principles in a National Party caucus room. And I thought, oh, God, what have I struck? Who am I working for? What am I doing this for?
You're working for, what was it? I don't want to interrupt you, but for those who are unaware, the profile of a corporate psychopath, and I believe I might have read this to you earlier, John, charming and enchanting when you first meet them, but are ultimately shallow, have few meaningful, long-lasting relationships, they crave money and power, and are willing to sabotage, intimidate, manipulate, steal, defame, lie, and cheat, and can do so shamelessly without guilt. They desire attention and idolization, and they have pathological narcissism and despise being criticized and are often sexually promiscuous. Now, if that doesn't nail to a T almost everybody who's a career politician, I don't know what does.
Maybe that's right. I mean, maybe I'm just too trusting. I don't particularly despise these people.
You know, the problem with people with a conscience is, you know, the people who have a conscience is, John, they think that everybody else is like them.
I mean, I've met a lot of politicians. I've worked for them. I don't say that the Nats are worse than Labor by any means, but let alone the Greens. But I just think they're all in it for the wrong reason. They perhaps get into it thinking they're going to do good, but they're pretty quickly kicked into line.
Well, activist Russell Malcolm said that if you want a leader, you want a leader who has one thing going for them, a track record of self-sacrifice for the greater good of others, all right? It doesn't matter what their business acumen is.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I chatted to this Chris Trotter, you know, the former Marxist commentator, who's a pretty good guy. He's come round a bit, I think, and he's he said it's a bit like Cincinnatus. Cincinnatus was this Roman guy who had been a politician or had been a leader, and he'd gone back to his plough, and they called him out of retirement to beat off some enemy, and then having become the hero of the hour, he went back to his plough. In other words, he wasn't at all affected by the fame and glory. He knew what was important to him, and it was his It was his cultivation or whatever it was.
He indeed, but, actually, Cincinnatus was called... It was called three times to go from farming to defend Rome, and three times he successfully beat back the enemies and then gave up his emergency powers over the entire empire and went back to farming. The third time, the Senate and the soldiers asked him to stay on and keep his emergency powers, but he denied them and then went back to farming and died a peaceful man.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you could fill me in on that. I think that what is called for, not just in little New Zealand, but everywhere, is politicians who don't want to be politicians. People, you know, the Icelanders did it. The Icelanders, in their hour of need, what did they do? They overthrew the government. They imprisoned the bankers. They refused to pay the bankers' loans. And I think they changed the constitution. And it was just a bunch of grassroots guys, as I understand it. Well, look, this can be done. This can be done if enough people think it can be done. The politicians have left it open for we, the people, to actually take our use our rights if we wish to. The trouble is most of us can't be bothered. We can get up parties and we can vote the buggers out and we can take them over with people with the right motivations.
It's true, but there's three factors I think that need to be come into. The first one we've just addressed, and that is who you actually want to run for politics. And that is, ergo, the people who don't want to run for politics are the people that should be running and be forced to. Not because of the money, not because of the power, but because of moral obligation and a desire to do the right thing. So you weed those out, you get those up, and you put that up. Secondly, is about identifying the actual problems that your country faces and what are the root causes of those issues. What are the root causes of our immigration problems, our monetary issues, the corruption in the media, the thing, you know, what ways to best solve these, then boom, you got your policies. And then the last one, I think, which is more the important issue, of thinking what your opposition is going to do to discredit you, to silence you, to censor you, to keep you out of the media, to pigeonhole you, to put you in the background, and come up with a counterintelligence strategy for each and every single one of their scumbaggery motivations to derail you, your party, and the honest, decent people from getting any kind of coverage and therefore support.
And that was a very real problem until the internet, until emails. Look, I want to propose to you a new political movement, and it does not require being covered by the mainstream media, does it? I mean, because look what we're doing now.
John, I totally dispute that. Name me one political party in New Zealand that has been elected that has not been on the mainstream media.
That is because you're basing the future on the past. I'm saying, what if we were the first? What if, I mean, who watches the news these days? I don't know. Who reads the papers these days? Very few, I think. Look how many people are on Facebook. They're not just putting up pictures of their meals, you know, not everybody. Some are. But a lot of us are debating and learning and sharing and becoming very informed. I talked to a very well-known New Zealander who says that I'm out of touch because I live in a small country town, Martinborough. And this is a guy that used to travel the world when nobody else did because he was a millionaire when he was 20. And I would say, yes, that was once the case. But nowadays, a little guy sitting in a little house in Martinborough can be extremely well connected. I'm on American Freedom Radio, folks. And there's people listening. And so if we are kept out of the mainstream media, which won't necessarily happen, because what I'm talking about is doing a Trump.
Who has appeared on mainstream media and had a mainstream talk show. It's about public profile.
But I mean, you do your best to get on mainstream media by being controversial and provocative. And even though they hate him, they can't afford not to run him. So we try that. We certainly do that by being very blunt and upfront and saying things in words of one syllable instead of nine syllables and being colourful and controversial and humorous and all those things that Well, Trump is doing. I'm not saying you become a carbon copy.
I've got
Trump.
Something.
I just say you learn from Trump.
I know, but I've got something that actually cauterizes this quite easy. If you want attention, create controversy, and if you want to create controversy, be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying you don't have to create controversy by doing anything shifty at all. You cut through the shiftiness and you go straight to the truth. And this is what people find very discombobulating, you know, when somebody just gets up and tells the truth.
We need to repeat I believe, two words over and over to people during the election campaign in order to get their head around this concept, false dichotomy, where you're given a choice between two really bad options.
Well, a lot of politics, a lot of life is a choice between bad and worse. I mean, that's something you can say. If you're on the right in politics, you're supposed to be the uncaring guy, and you're supposed to, want to stand for all sorts of bad and immoral things. But really,
as you said before, that's thinking in the past. We can change that. And we should try.
Because really what the right is, the economic right, is really the policeman who arrives at the accident and has to make some really tough calls. He might have to let that guy over there die, because these people over here are going to survive if he attends to them, but only if he attends to them and let that guy, you know, this is in grown-up world, this is the sort of stuff you have to do. And it's just like being a good parent. In many ways, politics is a bit like, let's be sexist. Let's say a choice between the strong, tough dad and the lovely but kind of soft mum, if there still are any like that. The soft mum is kind of popular, but, you know, she'll let the kids have the chocolates and whatever it takes to be popular. The tough parent wears the, and in my family, that is my wife. She was very tough with her son when it comes time to homework and all that. And there was tears every night. There was tears. He wanted to get on the Facebook. She wanted to do his homework. Well, guess what? He ended up ducks of his school because eventually he took on board what she was saying. So she was being the tough father, I guess, in that situation. And, you know, this is the sort of thing. If you're tough, if you make the tough calls, you get called a draconian right-wing bastard. If in a family, you get called a good parent. If you're if you're religious, if you're Christian and you believe in give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime, we call you a good Christian. Do the same in politics, you're a draconian right-wing bastard. So these are the sort of, when you say dichotomy, these are the sort of myths that have to be pushed through. From that particular perspective, you know, from the right winger thing, when you have to choose between bad and worse, you know, yes, some oil might wash up on a beach every so often. Bad is carrying on anyway with oil drilling and with industry and commerce. Worse is shutting down industry and commerce because of that very slight risk. And this is, you know, where you get a lot of political people get a lot of traction by going, panic and exaggerate. I call it 2468, panic and exaggerate. This is where the Green Movement gets most of its traction.
You'll be surprised,
to me, that
actually.
It's morally reprehensible to take worse instead of bad. You must take bad instead of worse, and you must try and find a good, you know.
I want to weaponize advertising, essentially. And you're a man who basically knows how to turn advertising into a weapon, essentially, a very effective weapon. And that's what politics has actually become. It's become an advertising and marketing gimmick contest.
Advertising has... Or no, politics has.
Politics.
Sorry.
I mean, think about it.
Who remembers
what the policies were of the parties that they voted for in the last election versus who remembered simply voting for them because they heard about them all the time and they thought, oh, this is really good, and they got these general impressions kind of thing. How do they think they did that? You know, just the subtle repetition.
Kind of sad, really. I mean, yeah, well, the campaign I did in 2005, we just had sort of one word on either side of a billboard. I had to persuade the National Party, which in New Zealand is the right-wing party, or supposed to be. And in New Zealand, unlike in America, that party is blue. And The other party, the Labour Party, is red, which makes sense to me, doesn't it? Because communism is red and Labour is socialist and all that. But I suggested to them that they might like to put Labour on half of their billboards, red on half of their billboard, and the Labour leader, Helen Clark, on half of the billboard. You can imagine how that was received. But we did it because they were sufficiently desperate, because they were down to 20% in the previous election. But the idea was to just put a word on either side. In the case of education, we had people coming up to us in the street and saying, oh, thanks for that billboard. We now understand what your education policy is. And we'd say, oh, what is it, madam? Oh, they stand for excuses and you stand for exams. So we just had, you know, we just had education at the top and excuses on the left in red and exams on the right in blue. And this was enough. This was code, you know. Iwi Kiwi was the one that is still talked about. Iwi in New Zealand means Maori tribe, and Kiwi means New Zealander. And the cleverness, I guess, was that the word Kiwi includes the word Iwi. In other words, the National Party at the time, under the leader at the time, was standing for racial equality. Everybody is an equal citizen, whereas the Labour Party were favouring the tribes. So Iwi Kiwi. So we did a lot of these, and I felt rather guilty because I was writing about, you know, six words a month, and these other guys were writing speeches and essays and stories in the newspaper and all the rest of it, and they weren't getting noticed, but the billboards were. And that is simply because life is busy. I mean, Brian Edwards is a sort of left-wing Irishman, the doyen of New Zealand interviewers he was at one stage, and I ended up on the radio with him, and he sort of damned me with faint praise, well, great praise, actually. He said, oh, that was a marvellous campaign. Let's take one at random. And I thought, oh, yeah, I know which one he's going to say. Iwi Kiwi, what does that mean? And he says, I'll tell you what it means. Iwi is Maori, and Kiwi is all other New Zealanders. I said, ah, stop right there, mate. Stop right there. Kiwi is all New Zealanders. That's the point. You're trying to say that it was racist. You're trying to say that the Kiwi side meant white people. Well, I'm not letting you get away with it. Furthermore, a billboard, Brian, is not an essay writing contest. The market is hurtling towards the medium at 100K or 180 in some cases, Brian. That was a reference to Helen Clark, the Prime Minister, being caught speeding through the countryside at 100K on the way to a rugby match. But you know, that's the point. There's nothing wrong with simplifying issues to that degree, as long as it's done honestly, as long as it's a fair representation of the points of view. And this is what I want this party, which I'm calling Free New Zealand, I want us to be the party that explains everything with crystal clarity, and when there is doubt, we debate. We debate both sides. Both sides. What do you think of that? I went to a debate on climate change at Victoria University of Wellington, and there were 10 debaters, and they were all warmists. They were all from the same side, and they call that a debate. This happens routinely in New Zealand. There was a constitutional debate. Okay. Dame Claudia Orange, I think, was the ringmaster, and all of the debaters were what I call treatafarians.
Yeah.
They were all from the same side.
Well, now, these are, in fact, wank fests, or as I like to call them, mass debates.
Mass debates, yes. Well done. You see, this is we can use humour, Vinny. Why can't we have fun pointing out these atrocious behaviours of our elites? And we're supposed to be the least corrupt country in the world.
Well, I would argue that we're now technically, according to Transparency International's Corruption Perception Index, notice there isn't a Corruption Reality Index, we're now the fourth perceived least corrupt country in the world. And I think that we slipped. All right, we've lost our game face here. We've lost our plans and everything. And we're becoming a bit more blatant. And now we're the fourth best country in the world at concealing our corruption.
Why was that? What caused us to go down? I could tell you a number of things, but why didn't they spot us before?
What's interesting is that nobody in the headlines or everything seems to elaborate as to why that is.
I suspect nations buy these by their ratings. I see Auckland's number two city in the world.
Number three.
After Vienna. I beg your pardon. After Vienna and what was number two? But is it really? I mean, how do they get these things? How do they get there? And why are we number two 1 year and number nine another year and number 14 another year? What changes with these cities?
Yeah.
So what do these things really mean? I think we do have a corruption problem in New Zealand. My little experience with the flag is one example, which won't excite people terribly much. But it just gives you an indication of the way that the elites can stifle dissent. Of course, it's a lot worse overseas, and bullets come into play over there, which don't happen here. I was working up to something, Vinny. You'll have to insert some words.
How do we actually define what's the best country in the world, or what's the best way of living, or whatever? And sometimes I define that by its lack of problems, not its apparent mountains of great stuff that you can point a stick at. Just more like, if there's an old saying, if you have to say, well, it's not that bad, then it's obviously not that great.
I think most countries aren't that great. I think we are the envy of many people in the world, I think, New Zealand, what they know about New Zealand, but that doesn't mean we have to rest on our laurels. I do have this idea of a goal. What would happen if we had a goal to be world champion nation, which means we have to, everybody in charge of a portfolio has to deliver a plan that will put New Zealand on the top of whatever the ranking system is, whether it's the PISA education survey or whatever. But there's always room for improvement. And it's not that hard if you have people running the country who are genuinely committed to, and my four principles of Free New Zealand are honesty, freedom, fairness, and excellence. They're the four pillars of the house of this proposed party. Honesty, freedom, fairness, and excellence. Honesty means that we are there to do the right thing. We are there to explain everything clearly. We have a prime minister who believes that explaining is losing. A lot of politicians believe that explaining is losing. I believe explaining is absolutely everything, but you must explain very, very clearly and simply because people are busy.
Yeah.
It's just common courtesy to boil things down as clearly as you can, as long as you've got a warehouse full of supporting evidence if they choose to go there. So,
There's nothing more annoying than a pain in the ass who doesn't really know what the hell he's talking about trying to convince you using a convoluted argument. That fucks me off.
Yeah. People who really understand things, they can explain things very simply. And the higher you go up in an organization, the better they are to deal with. I like doing ads for the top guy because the top guy is usually the brightest guy who has got there because of his ability to use words, information clearly and succinctly and honestly. And when there is something that is not agreed upon, you know, I tried to organise the ultimate global warming debate, and a lefty friend, I'm on the sceptic side now, I started off believing Al Gore's wonderful movie, and then I came to realise that there was about 35 lies in it.
Me too.
So I'm on the sceptic side now, but I really don't want my granddaughter to die in a conflagration. You know, if I'm wrong, I want to find out now. I will eat humble pie. That's one of the, you know, on the principle of honesty, we must accept when we get something wrong. We must admit mistakes. We must be prepared to change.
Sometimes you can tell from the outset who's right in a debate by seeing who actually shows up to represent their case. And if they virtually never show up to represent your case, then they're probably liars who have some kind of angle that they're working, and it might be using the issue for fear to gain more support, or they might be using it for fear to get people's money out of their pockets, but with just promises that you'll support them with that kind of stuff when you're just funneling it through international banks and taking a cut. I don't know. I'm just taking a stab in the dark.
Well, you know, this is my proposed debate went exactly that way. A guy leapt in. This was all on Facebook. A lefty friend leapt in and said, "Oh, I'll take you up on that, mate. I'll take you up on that. We'll have a debate and we'll film it and we'll make it a documentary and we'll all make money." And I said, "Oh, that'll be great. That'll be great. And everyone will know that it's fair because you and I are both coming from diametrically opposed positions, so we're not going to take any crap from each other. So it'll be interesting." And that's the sort of debate I think we should have. Now, I went away to get my skeptic team, and he went away to get his warmest team. And within about a day, I had a world-class, these are all scientists, a meteorologist, a climatologist, a geologist, a computer model.
We've lost John. However, there was this one lady one time who came up to me and she says, "You deny global warming. You deny climate change as a fact." And I go, no, I never denied that. It's been changed for 4 billion years. "You're a climate denier, though." And I go, "No, I never denied there was a climate." It's just, you know, pretends straw man argument debates with these people. It's really horrible. Look, as Mark Twain said, if you ever find yourself agreeing with the majority, you should be worried. The majority of people seem to be believe that taxing all forms of human activity, every form of carbon imaginable, is a really brilliant idea. Right? Right? That's essentially what it boils down to. It's not about environmentalism. It's not about doing anything like that. For me, that's what the climate change issue comes down to. And not unlike the fluoride debate, the people on one side just don't turn up to the debates. Right, it is very exceptionally rare to see someone turn up at a fluoride debate and debating in favour of fluoride itself. You know, that's just it's silly, but you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles, I guess. I really want to get away from this climate change issue a little bit because it seems to be a bit of a moot point, and we seem to be beating this dead horse. Because John and I talked about this earlier today, how he got a really professional skeptic team, and then the warmists left them all out in the cold, so to speak. You know, try that one on for size. It's pretty sad, isn't it? Now, there's a lot of issues that actually face New Zealand and face the world simultaneously. One of them is quite difficult to really imagine here. I think that if you want to talk about issues, politics sometimes isn't actually the place to have those kind of debates, because you're having a conflict between two opposite ideologies, and they have a vested interest in not betraying their ideology or admitting that they're wrong. You know, that's the problem with political debates, is that one of them's is that they're both trying to prevent themselves from looking wrong. Now, I think a scientific debate, a real scientific debate, not a falsely, you know, financed by corporate banks one, is about getting to the truth for the truth's sake. If I am wrong, let me be wrong. If I am right, let the evidence be produced that proves I am right. That very solid benchmark is something that we should strive for in all elements of our media and our politics, you name it. Honesty and integrity has been systematically wiped out of late because the people with the money, I'm not talking about somebody who's got like $100,000 in the bank or $1 million or even $10 million. I'm talking about the people with the money. Billionaires. There's an old saying, if you made $1 million, it was because you worked for it. If you made $1 billion, it's because you stole it. might not necessarily be 100% true, but in the broad scheme of things, in our generalizing propensity society, I think it actually sums it up quite nicely. Because a man who snatches a lady's handbag and steals $100, he does a bit of damage to that lady, he breaks her handbag, she feels traumatized, and she doesn't have $100 for food or a utility bill or something. You know, that's really terrible. But a man spends $100 million buying off the entire US Congress, both sides of the House, and gets them to pass laws that give his company unfair advantages against independent owner-operators, and wind up making him billions, plus giving him lots of extra subsidies on the side that was stolen from taxpayers in the first place. Think about the fucking damage that guy can do. It's not the poor people that you should be worried about. It's the people you never hear about that are secretly controlling things from behind the scenes. And until that becomes an honest political reality, there will not be honest political representation for people from any countries at all, I don't think. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. This is a listener-supported broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Please do me a favor, go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and start up a donation of a regular automatic payment, either into that Kiwi Bank or into that PayPal. Ladies and gentlemen, you are financing this platform that gives debating opportunity in an honest fashion to anybody who seeks to be on it. We'll be right back after the break. Thank you very much for supporting me so far, all of you that do. Back in a tick. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's pretty awesome, isn't it? Now the whole idea that we were trying to get to is those second term issues. You bring up the crisis just so that you can milk the fucking popularity about it, isn't it? And if you do wind up turning up to a debate that you think that you're going to lose, then it kind of threatens your popularity gap, doesn't it? A little bit. Sound familiar? Now, we made a point earlier in the first hour as well about Auckland's livability, right? Being ranked the third most livable city on Earth, apparently. Now, a lot of people are actually perplexed by this. Like, oh my God, Auckland is so horrible. It's just like, bro, have you seen cities like Jakarta, Tokyo, Los Angeles, you know? Developed though they may be, they have huge, glaring, horrible details about them that Auckland simply doesn't have. You know, we don't have tuk-tuks and mopeds everywhere weaving in between the cars. There isn't trash all over the street. There are generally no lines at the bank or anywhere for that matter due to the low population density. Traffic is bad for a few hours in the morning and the evening, as opposed to all day every day. And smog doesn't visibly hang over the city like a thick and dirty duvet 24 hours per day. Lots of reasons. But still, it's a city. Some people don't like living in a city because they prefer a quiet, slower life where they can be part of a small community and have that kind of spirit. And I understand that desire, but I kind of don't share it. You know, I was born in Auckland, and after seeing a few small towns and big cities elsewhere in the country and around the world, I kind of dig it, man. Personally.
And everyone's got a beach.
Well, just the married ones. Hey.
Everyone's got a beach. That's the thing I like about Auckland. But house prices are horrendous, aren't they?
Dude, there was like news reports of like one Chinese investor coming in and buying 56 homes in a day. Had another friend tell me that he lives on a street where one guy bought up the entire street, you know? It's like, dude, we're actually becoming tenants in our own country because there's a lot more billionaires and millionaires overseas than there are here, and they've got a lot more money to throw around than this entire country does. And so it's inevitable, mathematical, that New Zealanders wind up not owning their own country anymore.
Is there not another issue up there as well? I'm told that the thing they call the Metropolitan Urban Limit, which I call the Great Wall of Auckland, is there because of a bunch of green planners. Apparently the planners in Auckland City, of whom there are hundreds or thousands, all come out of the same universities and they're all subscribed to the green philosophy. In a country that has more land per capita than just about anyone, we've all got to live in the middle, apparently. Now, if you tore down the wall, see, in parts of the States, for our American listeners who probably know this, a city like Houston, you get a house that would cost over $1 million in Auckland, you'd get it for $250,000 in Houston because they don't have the same green scam operating. In other parts of the States, like Portland, they do, and houses are 8 times more expensive than they are in Houston. But what's happening in Houston? I think there's 6 million people there now. They're all flocking out of California into Houston. So why don't we have that option? We've got a guy called Hugh Pavlicek, who is behind the demographia surveys, which are quoted in all the major papers around the world. And he rates the affordability of housing in numerous markets. And, you know, the New Zealand house prices are astonishingly high on world scale. The only place in the world that he's found that where the house prices are reasonable are parts of America where they don't have this green urban planning. But we in Auckland, I think we've got a median multiple of 9. That means the average house price is 9 times higher than the average wage. And affordable is counted as 3, a median multiple of 3. Well, there's nowhere in New Zealand with a median multiple of 3, I don't think, Auckland being the worst. So why are we allowing that? Is it all because of wealthy Chinese, or is it that plus the...
Oh, no, it's just one aggravating factor.
Stupid insistence that we all live in shoeboxes in the middle of town. That's
here's the thing.
To the Kiwi way of life, isn't it?
Here's the thing. It's really easy to get people worked up about all those Chinese investors and all of that kind of stuff. It ain't as easy to get people worked up and about an Agenda 21 protocol planning process that is actually restricting cities all around the world and creating forced green zones. And the eventual plan is to fill those inner metro areas with giant skyscrapers with tiny little apartments for all the slaves to live in along railroad tracks so that they won't be able to travel into unauthorized zones after all of the motorways have been walled off, and they'll be trapped inside, and all the green areas outside the city will soon be evacuated and there won't be a rural place to live. You will be living in a town, in a slave block at best.
Yeah. I mean, these are the issues that people are, I think, becoming more and more aware of thanks to this wonderful capitalist invention called the internet and shows like yours. You know, what I want is a political party, political movement that places very high in its set of principles the principle of clarity and open debate. What I was saying before about the climate debate was that I got together my team of skeptics, world-class skeptics, in no time flat, and the other guy, the lefty warmest guy, couldn't find one and still can't find anybody, any climate scientist anywhere on planet Earth that will defend the so-called science. What does that tell you about the truth of that particular scam? You know, if you were a member of the Round Earth Society and you were pretty convinced that the Earth was a globe, and the Flat Earth Society came to you, who had been causing quite a lot of trouble in the media, insisting that it was flat, if they came to you and challenged you to a debate, wouldn't you want to accept so that you could flatten them and flatten your enemy once and for all so that they no longer had any media profile? But no, these guys, they say, they make all sorts of excuses why they won't debate the skeptics. But really, you would. If you were telling the truth, you'd debate them. But they won't anywhere. And so, to me, debate, open debate, two-sided debate is crucial. And we would do that with a grid system where all issues were debated point by point, side by side, in a tabular format, in writing.
But I also put a caveat on that? There has to be a moderator, okay? Because there's often things like logical fallacies, for example, there's a whole bunch of different types of logical fallacies. A moderator actually needs to know what those are, how to look for them, how to know who's actually moving the debates. They also need to keep out people who are abusive, who are trying to derail things. It's actually, it's a serious process having a debate. Now, on the internet, debate can be a lot better than the classic hall with Team A and Team B, because Team A can present evidence. Team B can present evidence, not just quote it, but actually show you the sources, the documents, the readouts, and can read them off the screen unprompted, etc. Now, the debate might take actually quite a long time. It might go over a successive period of weeks or months. However, it means that you can annex years of debate that would have happened if you had you not sat down to debate it properly.
Quite agree with you. And imagine putting that in writing. It's a bit like a court case, but a court case evaporates, you know. If you weren't there, you don't really know what happens. You rely on being mediated by the mediocre media. In this case, each side would have an incentive to strip down their case to a manageable number of words, the most telling words that they could find, and they would be put against the best of the other side on each particular sub-issue of the broader issue. So the ordinary person wanting to follow a subject could do so in this, you might call it trial by clarity, in this side-by-side format, and it would be there for all time. It would be there for all time, so it wouldn't evaporate. So this is just one of the ideas that a Free New Zealand party would, and frankly, Free New Zealand could be Free Texas, could be free anywhere with voters, Free Martinborough, where I am. But the idea of raising a clarity to a high property in its own right, honesty, freedom, the freedom of every individual to lead the life they want, as long as they don't get in someone else's way and stop leading them the life they want. Fairness, when you get to an issue like climate change, an issue like our treaty grievance industry we have here in New Zealand, it's really an industry, where lies are being told quite routinely, just like on the climate thing. I mean, you've got the whole of academia is on one side only, just like the whole of academia is climate alarmists, you know. You're not allowed to graduate from a New Zealand university unless you tug your forelock to the Maori radicals, not ordinary Maori. Many of them are on the same side as me on this. They just want racial equality. They want to live their lives free of patronisation. But a whole lot of lies are being told relating to the founding treaty of New Zealand that is not really the Treaty of Waitangi, which is what we think it is, but what they're really arguing about is the Treaty of Wellington, 1989, dreamed up out of thin air, like our paper money is, Vinny, by Sir Geoffrey Palmer, the biggest traitor in New Zealand history. He dreamed up this fantasy treaty complete with principles. The only principles in the actual Treaty of Waitangi were that the Maori ceded sovereignty to the British in exchange for a wonderful gift that no other native people on earth possessed, which was equal citizenship of the greatest empire on earth, the British Empire at the time, and protection from the French and from each other, from tribes that were going to come from the south to avenge previous raids from the north, from when Hongi Hika had muskets and the others didn't. So there was a very clear set of principles in the treaty, the principle of equality being the main one, but Geoffrey Palmer dreamed up a whole lot of others, and now there is a whole industry devoted to extorting money from the descendants of those British settlers.
Now, I had this debate with somebody at a kitchen table at a friend's house. Now, she's from Fiji, and we were talking about race and the relationships between them. She became hostile all of a sudden, and she talked about people being persecuted, people being treated by their skin color and not their character and such and blah, blah, blah. And I said, imagine for a moment that you're talking with somebody that agrees with every single thing that you've just stated and doesn't want that to be the way things are anymore. And she just sat back and went, wow, okay. See, sometimes the greatest problem that we have is a failure to communicate. John Ansell's just dropped out again. So now it seems to me that a lot of people, and I get these comments coming up on a Martin Dutre video about the ancient cultures that were here before Maori, right? Megalithic structures and things of that nature that predate what earlier estimates for the Maori arrival in New Zealand aboard the waka, or the big canoes. A little bit fancier than a canoe. Way more fancy. Quite advanced, actually, I reckon. Got sails and everything on it. Kind of like a catamaran, you know? A little bit. Catamaran with a little house on it. Beautiful. Navigate by the stars. Pretty awesome, right? See, having a look at the things in reality and knowing that every human being deserves to be treated with respect and everything needs to be communicated openly, honestly, with integrity, without hostility. It's so much better to express the reasons why you're angry rather than expressing the anger itself. This is where the debate gets derailed. Now, John was talking earlier about how the internet was a great capitalist invention. I'd like to take issue with that because I don't think capitalists per se invented the internet. I think the internet has actually facilitated capitalism, but it was actually invented by technocrats. We really want to have a way to control information and control what people do, but it just kind of got out of the hand, you know? Became so popular because people around the world have been stifled by the inability to communicate. This is what we want in our human culture, our social media and all of that kind of stuff. We want to be able to communicate with people. Pretty straightforward, I would have thought. Wouldn't it be nice to have a world that is not run by ruthless criminal sociopathic scum, not manipulated by... It's not stupid people that are doing the manipulating, it's people who are actually quite intelligent. People forget that. They have no idea just how bright people who are really bad can be. I feel that our inherent failure at attempting to get these things worked out isn't entirely our fault. You know, I mean, we've got the capacity to get informed about things. We now have choice with the internet, a whole lot of people think, but I'm like, nah, bro. Your choices are still very much restricted. What do I mean by that? Okay, well, let's say you're not you, you're somebody else. You were born to different parents in a different place. Let's say your father was a warlord in sub-Saharan Africa, and your mother was a woman that he raped while he killed her villagers. Then imagine you're somebody else who was raised in Manhattan, and your father is a millionaire entrepreneur, and your mother is a singer-songwriter. Let's say that two different people, right? And you come up to me and tell me that these two people have the same choices in life. No. No, they don't. Okay? They have the same challenges inherently at a gut level in life. They do not have the same choices. They do not have the same circle of people around them. They do not have the same influence that they can be subjected to. You know, they can't have their mentors and what have you. It's actually quite difficult, isn't it? Kind of like sitting there on radio, waiting for the producer to hear that your guest isn't around. It's Attila the Unfortunate. It really is. But as I was saying, those two different people, they do not have the same choices, and it is absolutely arrogant and totally naive to assume that they do, and that they're totally responsible for how their life turns out. No two people are exactly the same. No two people's situation is exactly the same. And I think what John's talking about is a government system that actually will take people from different walks of life, all different walks of life, and give them the same tools to better themselves, to better their communities, to better the country as a whole. Because I think that a country is actually very small. A country is one person. If there's one person in your country that's really not well off and is not being helped, is not progressing, has gotten themselves into a cycle of drugs and alcohol, who don't feel fulfilled with their jobs, then the country itself is sick it's going in the wrong direction. In a country that is run perfectly, everybody would have variations, but they'd be very, very similar in the way that they live their lives, and there'd be very few disadvantaged people. The only people who'd be very disadvantaged are the people who actually made a choice to put them there, not people who had those choices made for them via their misfortunate birth. People always talking about, oh, these useless leaders, or there's too many people and all of that kind of thing. And it's just like, dude, people are being exterminated left, right and centre, and you're sitting here complaining about overpopulation and saying that it might be justifiable to have huge wars that exterminate millions of souls like that, to release viruses, to make entire cultures vanish. You need your head read, bro. You haven't grasped the concept, the sanctity of human life. If somebody did it to me, how would I feel? That, in and of itself, is how you measure the sanctity of human life. I go to a party, and I see a really drunk person. And I say to her, look, you're really drunk. Do you want to go up to the house and get you a couple of glasses of water in you? Because that's what I'd want someone to do for me. See somebody who's just had a bit too much and just needs a little bit of water. Those are those simple principles. You see a problem, solve a problem. See somebody being a dick, say something to them about it. Expose them, you know. Be a hero. Seriously. Heroes get killed, but some of them live forever. Never forget that. I can't believe that I'm living in a society that exonerates and loves and devotes themselves to a superhero movie culture. And we're a pack of cowards. We don't embody those principles of courage, of self-sacrifice, of creativity, and of the use of power to protect those who have none. Very few people embody those principles, even though it is within their power to start embodying them today without any preparation. Just start doing it a little step at a time. You'll soon find out what you're made of. You'll find out that you're not made of glass. You don't shatter instantly as soon as you're tapped. There is something deeper at work here in the human condition, something that is not going to be addressed or brought up to you in the mainstream media, something that's not going to be fully explained to you in a 90-minute film produced by Hollywood. There are deeper recesses of people's potential that I just wish that they would see. There's a lot of potential in me that I still haven't fulfilled yet, and it pisses me off every day, and it motivates me, because you know what's a hell of a lot more motivating than depression and sitting by yourself and not really doing anything because you feel really bad about the way shit is? By actually fucking doing something about it. That's right. That's the reason you feel depressed. It's the reason you feel angry. It's the reason you feel afraid. Because you're meant to be doing something about the things that you see. John and I had this debate before the show today. These kind of people that you need to seek political power be the people who don't want it. That's it. I'm sick of the endless debate about who would be the best worst option. I'm sick of the false dichotomy. Choices with no good outcome. I am perplexed at how such a system could have come to be without people awakening to it. And that, I think, is just a denotation of how intelligently this apparatus of deception has been put in place to blind everybody from the truth. Because, let's face it, people who are honest and have integrity, they don't hurt people. Not a lot of the time. Unless those people have done something very wrong. And they have a moral obligation to retaliate, bring them to justice, etc. Death is part of life, but one thing that really makes me fearful, you know, just sends shivers down my spine, is when I see comments on message boards and people on their talk radio shows and things of that nature talking about killing the police or stringing up the politicians. These are concepts I'm familiar with. I had these thoughts at one time. However, a revolution that is founded in blood will only end in blood. There is another way. It is not peaceful revolution or violent revolution. There has to be a way of making society different to the lopsided, this way or the other way, false dichotomy that we've been living in almost every conceptual idea, be it religion, science. This has to stop. We have to stop making false choices. Maybe this is probably the issue of the day for a lot of us activists, because we have seen the system be the way it is for, I guess the words are, long enough to dedicate our lives to changing it. And I'd say, I saw this video the other day that claimed that approximately 25% of the population was awake. I can't even fathom the naivete of that remark. If I'm being honest, I would say there's about 1% of people that are awake, if that, maybe 0.85. Now, that's not to say that everybody has the same idea. No. I feel that if society is going to change, then the people who are running society need to change. Now, and if they're not going to change willingly, then we've got to come up with some very creative tactics in order to disperse them. There's something very wrong with this country. And I'm saying that on the radio to people from all around the world. And it still resonates, doesn't it? There's something wrong with this country, isn't there? People don't even put their finger on it. And essentially, it's the accumulation of money and power in various centres of society, which can be seized control of and ratcheted up for the benefit of scumbaggery, psychopathic people who only crave money and power. See how that works? Government. You'd say that those positions hold a lot of power. Well, let's have a look. What can the New Zealand Prime Minister do once he's elected? Well, he can appoint the heads of all of the cabinet. The office of the Prime Minister is not a creature of statute at all. It doesn't even have to reply to Official Information Act requests if it doesn't want to. All right? That's how corrupt this country is. That's how powerful the Prime Minister is. The Prime Minister, if he wanted to, can have you arrested at your dinner party when you're sitting around there with your friends, and hold you in a police cell all night without charge, and have police surveil you and just camp out down the road from you just to make sure that you know that somebody's watching you. Shut down your business, contact the banks and order them to call in the mortgages on your loans and everything like that, and just in order to conceal a little bit of political corruption that would have been exposed during an election season. That's how powerful the office of the Prime Minister is. Never forget who you're up against. This is what really pisses me off, actually. People don't know what they're dealing with. Oh my God. The AFR is actually reconnecting John Ansell. It's only been like 20 or 30 minutes. This is better late than never. John, welcome back.
G'day.
We've been having some technical issues at the thing. I think the network owner was on the phone with somebody having a very important phone call, which kind of interrupted. So, look, I also want to apologize to the audience for that undue interruption and apologize to you as well, John. But I will also like to explain it, which is what you do when you're losing, apparently, is that, look, we're not being paid to do this. We're not professional. We're professional because we're doing it out of the brotherhood of man, because we're not racists. We believe in one race, the human race, and we're all brothers and sisters at the end of the fucking day.
Yeah, well said. I was listening to you, though. I tuned in, and I was impressed with that business about courage. When you do stand up, I used to be a very timid person, paralyzed with fear of public speaking, but at a certain point, I just got too angry. Too sick of being a coward, I guess. I was a coward for a long time on this political stuff. It is invigorating, Vinny, isn't it? You started a lot younger than me. But when you do stand up and you take a few hits, you find you can actually take them because you are actually speaking the truth. In the end, if you're speaking the truth and if you're making it your best fist of it and you are speaking from integrity and you're stating things which, while they might be sharp, they are nonetheless true, no one can get you, even if they kill you. I've been threatened with beheading for saying certain things on the Mana Party website about racial equality. You cannot believe in racial equality in New Zealand. And American friends, the situation here with the Maori tribes is very different from the situation that the British faced and the things the British did in other parts of the world. By the time they got to New Zealand, they were wet liberals, in fact. But anyway, so you speak up on these things and you do get called all sorts of names. But then you find that a lot of people actually stand up with you. They don't necessarily stand up with you. They sort of sneak up to you afterwards and say, well, yeah, that was really good, you know. This is the issue we face here. In New Zealand, we have a Prime Minister who is giving away, as we speak, the drinking water, the control of the drinking water, to tribal corporations. These corporations that are really phony tribes that have been enriched by the desire for both the Labour Party and National Party to curry favour with Maori voters.
That reminds me, I had a conversation with the commander about this, and he said that I think maybe it was in the 60s or the 50s that a whole lot of the big major tribes, all these people started marrying into the tribes and things like that. They started kicking out all the traditionalists from any of the positions, that kind of thing, and it corrupted the whole process, and then they created a treaty settlement process and such and blah, blah, blah. It was kind of like a marriage-led coup.
Well, I was talking to Mike Moore. I used to work for the Labour Party, did three elections for the Labour Party before I did one for the National Party. And I was talking to Mike Moore, and he was very proud of having resolved the treaty settlement process in favour of the tribes as opposed to the individuals. I think that was absolutely wrong. As soon as they said, oh, well, we're going to pay the tribes, suddenly the tribes had a lot more members. People who didn't even know that they were Maori or didn't even know that they had a tribe suddenly had a tribe. and suddenly the tribes were full of people. And these have become corporations. The money does not filter down to the average Maori person. It's just kept by the guys at the top for the most part. And now these guys are they're bullies, but, you know, a lot of people are bullies. But they can bully the white man. They bully the weak appeaser governments that we have, and they won't stop bullying until someone bullies them back. And they are now bullying John Key because the Maori Party effectively have the balance of power. They are saying we want control of fresh water, which means the stuff that is 70% of your body mass. And New Zealanders are not particularly perturbed about that. They don't really particularly know. And it's been given away via the regional councils so that John Key doesn't get the blame. This is why we need not only a free New Zealand party, but we need a free Auckland, we need a free Greater Wellington, free Waikato.
You could do it suburb by suburb, bro. You could have a free Otahuhu.
Exactly. You can, because we're a local issue. We've got a local issue of a very high-handed council here in the little town of Martinborough, which needs sorting out. They need to be swept from office. Well, yeah. But this regional councils, we need a party that will get on the regional councils and say to the voters who are normally asleep at local body election time, they haven't got a clue who's representing them.
Oh, I wouldn't blame them.
We need to say to people, look, if you don't want to have to beg the local iwi for a glass of water, you need to vote for this team, not just part of the team, but the whole team, so it can control the regional council that is being given the ability or the job of negotiating with the local iwi. I stood up to Suwira Gardner at a meeting here in Martinborough, the local government commission, on Tuesday night. The local government commission is trotting around New Zealand trying to justify their existence by persuading communities to merge, because the government only want to deal with a few local people. So they want all these communities to merge, and the local communities don't want to merge. So now the local government commission have had four losses and no wins. So they're more humble. And so Weira Gardner, who's Maori, as was his predecessor, Basil Morrison, is saying, you know, we're a lot more democratic now and we're a lot more interested in what you think. And that got me going. I got up and said, hang on, not so fast on the democratic. Your local government commission once again is talking about racist representation. Up and down this country, race-based wards and boards and committees and advisory panels with voting rights, unelected. And fortunately, in local government, they have binding referenda, which we should have in national government. But every time they institute these boards, 80% of the public vote no and kick them out. So I said to Sue, why are you doing it again? Why are you costing us money? We're just going to kick it out again. But this is New Zealand, and they will push until somebody pushes back. And what there needs to be in New Zealand is a political movement that pushes back on all things unfair, this being one. In Auckland, you have to grovel to 13 different tribes to replace a building, a window in an office block, as Sir Robert Jones found. You have to basically bribe the tribe. Why? Because some of their ancestors used to gather pippies where the window was being placed. You know, this is ridiculous. But this is New Zealand. This is the sort of thing that's been allowed to happen through no opposition, because we're all too nice. And if we continue being nice, this is why I admire what Trump is doing, because Trump he's touched a nerve. He understands human nature. All the people that don't understand human nature, all the dishonest people, all the media commentators, they haven't got a clue what's going on. But Trump knows how to connect with ordinary people, and we need the same sort of group here to do the same sort of thing and institute honest. All Trump is he's two things. He's a guy who talks like a guy, and he's a New Yorker, and New Yorkers are very direct. And that's really what he's doing. He's controversial because he's direct. He tells the truth. You still there, Vinny?
Yeah.
Oh, you are. Yeah, you go to New York and they say they have signs like, littering is selfish, so don't do it. here we have keep New Zealand tidy. Yeah, that's all Trump is. He's just brusque and brash but he gets to the point.
I don't know. For me, I just think the whole fawning over Trump that I sometimes see in the American media is like, yeah, you know, the one thing that a country that's been corrupted by scumbag billionaires who have a whole lot of dirt in their past so they're easy to blackmail needs? A scumbag billionaire who's got a lot of bad stuff in his past that he could easily be blackmailed. I mean, that'll solve everything.
Well, if he's a scumbag, I don't equate rich with scumbag necessarily. I mean,
billionaire and trillionaire with scumbag. Not millionaire, not rich. But if you're a billionaire, there's no possibility you did that 100% honestly. There's just no way. Hell of a lot of people got trampled underway up that hill, man. You can make $100 million without hurting a single person, but you can't make a billion.
What is the difference between 100 million and a billion, really? I mean, I don't defend corruption. I just need to see proof of it. I just think when somebody finds a way to service people, to creates a product or a service that helps people, if they do it well enough, they become a big business. If they do it very well, they become a corporation, and then we're supposed to hate them. I don't quite follow that line of
Certainly,
if you've got something against someone, if you've got some evidence that someone is corrupt, he's honest enough to say, yeah, I give to both sides. You know, I have to. It's business. You go to a foreign country, you have to bribe the customs officer. Does that make you a bad person?
Of course not.
It makes you a practical. You have to do it to get in. A New Zealand company that wants to do business in, you know, Sierra Leone or somewhere probably has to pay backhanders to people. Mm. Does that make that business person corrupt?
I don't know. Does hanging out with child molesters, human traffickers, gun runners, and drug dealers who are also billionaires and going to exclusive clubs and things of that nature willy-nilly, where such activities are rumoured and in fact proven to have gone on, does that make them a scumbag? The answer is probably.
Well, it does. As soon as they do something dishonest and corrupt, yeah, absolutely.
Well, see, you need to look in Ed, the Opperman Report is another show that's on here, and I interviewed the host, Ed Opperman, and he's a private investigator who lives down in Florida, and he did a whole bunch of digging into Trump's background and his past and his history, his associations and things like that, and it's not good. It was kind of a real eye-opener for me, because I was initially like, yeah, this is going to be great. But I still want Trump to win, though. I want to put a caveat on that. I still want Trump to win. But for one reason only, the entertainment value. During the inauguration ceremony, when Trump gets up and Obama passes the mantle to him, Trump's going to turn to Obama and go, "You're fired."
Well, look, you know, who do you? Someone said to me the other day, a lady, woman friend here in Martinborough, she said, you know, she can't stand Trump, she wouldn't vote for him because of what he said about Megyn Kelly, which wasn't very nice at all. You know, she's got blood coming out of her eyes, she got blood coming out of her wherever. Okay, that's a bad thing to say. That's not very nice. Is that a game breaker when you're trying to pick someone to stand up for your country, to stand up for your country against a killer like Putin? You know, or do you maybe say, well, that wasn't very nice, but it's not a deal breaker because it shows that he's, you know, the way the guy goes on. I mean, he stands up to the Pope, he stands up to everybody. He doesn't care about the effect on ratings because he knows that he's going to go up because he understands human nature. Above all, what Americans are saying is that they want someone strong to deal to this crony capitalist system. Now, he may have had to play the crony. I don't know. I don't know enough about him.
Well, I know the American political process.
He knows how to win. He knows how to win, and he knows how to build quality things. That's what I notice. And he knew how to build the skating rink done in New York, this big skating rink. And it's interesting listening to the processes he used and how he went about getting it done so quickly when the state had failed. Well, the city had failed for years and years. So he's a practical guy, and he can bang heads and get things built. Now, that's worth something. That goes on the positive side of Trump. There may be things on the negative side. There always will be.
Has he a track record of self-sacrifice for the good of others without a profit motive?
Well, he did that skating ring. But no, I don't know. That is not necessarily... required.
Ooh, this actually gives me a really good idea, John.
Because it doesn't have to be a deal breaker either, because you haven't done anything.
Well, let's not think about the deal breaker, but let's think about why people make their political choices and why they do it. And it's, again, as we were talking about previously, it comes down to that clever marketing. All right, now you must understand, because you're a marketer, that Trump's using marketing techniques in his speeches.
Oh yeah,
all right. So that means we're
make
under
America great again. That's right.
Exactly. And what's the marketing that you've got to do when somebody's driving 180 kilometers an hour? A very simple impression. That's all you've got to leave.
America great again. And people say, you know, Don Brash, I was talking to him the other day, he says that Trump is a buffoon. Bob Jones says Trump is a buffoon. Well, he's a buffoon with a lot more buildings than Bob. The guy's not a buffoon. He is an expert marketer. He is completely blindsiding all of these seasoned politicians and all of the commentators by paying attention to single-minded communication, as you say. But this is how he's been all his life. This is how he's won so much, I guess. He's a raging egomaniac. Now, is that a deal breaker? A lot of people would say it is. You know, say, we don't want someone who's so full of himself. Well, you know,
as if anybody's seen a speech by Bruce Lee or Muhammad Ali, and you say, "Oh, well, somebody
Muhammad
who's
Ali.
So full of themselves," like they sometimes people are full of themselves because they've actually got something really good going on, bro.
You know, you've got an ego. I've got an ego. We're talking. We're on the radio. We're big shots in this little hour of ours. You've got to push forward, and he just happens to have pushed forward further than anybody else, and he's unashamed. The thing about him is he's not ashamed of the things that he says. He doesn't immediately backpedal when he does a quick poll and finds that something's backfired, mainly because it's not backfiring, but even if he did, he wouldn't do it because he says, this is me. This is me. This is who I am. This is what I've analyzed is going to work, and take me or leave me. I kind of like that. I don't like everything about him, but I kind of like that aspect. Would you rather, as I said to this woman friend in Martinborough here, I said, would you rather have a guy who's unfailingly polite but weak, or a guy who is brusque and occasionally very rude but strong and gets things done? That, I think, is the equation, and that, I think, is where Trump comes out on top, assuming that he can buy the best advice and get the best decisions.
Buy the best advertising is the word.
I know what you're going to say. No. Well, advertising. Nothing kills, as I know, nothing kills a bad product quicker than good advertising. You know, because you're just drawing attention to defects. Look at all the money that Jeb Bush has spent compared with what Trump is. The almost nothing that Trump has spent, because Trump's got all his publicity free by being a colourful character and a provocative character.
Oh, we need to use these people, the mainstream media dipshits, you know?
Well, it's important to be loved and hated, I think. It's not a very good thing to say, testament of human character, but it's much better to be loved and hated than to be just kind of bland and ignored, as all these other candidates are finding out to their cost.
What I think is if you're hated by both the right and the left, then you're probably correct.
Well, I think he is. but there's a whole bunch in the middle who are not particularly political necessarily, who evidently love him. I mean, I think he's going to go all the way, but he's absolutely certainly going to go, going to be the Republican nominee, surely. I mean, this time tomorrow should prove that. And it's why? Because he's larger than life and people think, hey, this guy can get things done. And they forgive all the other stuff.
Now I've been
they're taking a chance.
I've been working on this Free New Zealand idea, just kind of like brain teasing it, because I wanted to turn it into an acronym, and I think I got one. Free: fairness, responsibility, equality, and education.
Fairness, responsibility, equality. Well, yeah, that'll do. I mean, education. We need to sweep clean all the bullshitters in universities and schools. You know, exactly. It's just a Marxist propaganda unit, our education system.
Well, may I make a point on that as well? Because we're dealing with a system that actually, if you're the government, you automatically have to veto and go, yes, I agree with anybody having to have their children go to school to a brainwashing institution that tells them to love the government and to not question and to kill their creativity. Okay, we have the power to force people to do that. That's terrible. And that affects every single person in their daily life for the rest of their life. Now, I think that is number one priority, really, in order to reset the future, is you need to educate an entire new generation in a new way of thinking, with grammar, with logic, being able to problem solve, and being able to ask the right questions, and be able to express their creativity wisely, and be able to do
damn
these things.
And, now, keep their, and be confident, but also respectful, but confident of their point of view, develop a point of view by being educated by from history, from real history. God knows, we God forbid, I was going to say, we might even teach them about the Enlightenment and some of the wonderful heritage that they've inherited from the British and Europeans in our background. You know, we're not supposed to feature that anymore, but the institutions that make the English-speaking countries great are worth knowing about, and but I don't know if we get that.
What if it was possible, John, to teach someone how to teach themselves who they really are? What if your teacher gave you an assignment, John, to say, "Hey, look, you know what you need to do? You need to go on the computer and you need to find out your family tree and your entire bloodline and try to trace it back. And you will find that it's one of only a half a dozen bloodlines that existed originally on the planet."
Yeah, we all come from East Africa, don't we, in the end? That's why we, you know, the race that matters. I'm deeply racist. I'm absolutely, totally partial towards one race, and that is the human race. I mean, if we thought more like that, instead of thinking, you know, that we're sort of separate, we would have a coherent country and a coherent world. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about living now, is we are able to meet people. You know, I've got a Facebook friend in Greenland. I can't believe it. But, you know, how does that happen? But that's the wonders of our system, which you have to give credit to capitalism for
Which reminds me, we only have about a minute left, but we need to take this into the argument about direct democracy and using technology to give people an input in the government and even to pass their own legislation. Could you imagine, ladies and gentlemen, that you were sent an email by the government saying, we need you to look over this document and get back to us with a yay or nay. And that document has 10 simple bullet points that are condensed condensed into really, really easy 10-year-old English that anybody could understand about what this piece of legislation is called, what it does, what its purpose is going to be, and how it's going to affect people, and yay or nay on it, right? That would be a great way, I think, of passing legislation very quickly and efficiently, with everybody having their say without any bullshit rigmarole or underhanded tactics.
Online voting, why not? The powers that be will not want it, but this is what a party that is truly progressive would be insisting upon. Like the Swiss. The Swiss have had direct democracy for over 100 years. It works well. Nobody can remember the name of the Swiss Prime Minister because everyone gets a turn. And that's the kind of democracy I like, from the people.
Exactly. The only people you want to have power over you are the people who don't want to have any power over you.
I don't believe in the wisdom of crowds unless the crowd is informed. But the wisdom of the informed crowd is the best we can do. We have to trust each other as long as we've got the facts. As long as all the people have got the facts.
Facts are very important, ladies and gentlemen, almost as important as email. And thank you very much, John, for your contributions on the show. What little interruption has caused there. That's very unfortunate. But what was your website again, bro?
I'm really operating from my Facebook page at the moment.
All right, well, anybody, just check him out. John Ansell on Facebook. That's A-N-S-E-L-L. He's an advertising guy and sells things. You know, see, Ansell, that's how it works. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen, to this technically plagued broadcast. And we will see you again sometime in a professional fashion, assuredly. See you again.